were started in Baltimore, and in March of this year, we moved to Oakland, California, where we merged with the Women's Press Collective, the oldest women's press in the country. And so we added to the works that we have in print, the works by Judy Gron, Pat Parker, and Sharon Isabel. On October 25th, our plant in Oakland was vandalized. Some people broke into it in the middle of the night and really did a number. They went through our equipment and poured cleanser and chemicals and paint in all of our presses. We have five, and four of them were badly damaged. They took the paste up and negatives and plates of all of our past books and tore them up and ripped them up and threw them on the floor. And they took the paste up from three of our fall books that we were just getting ready to print and tore that paste up in half right down through the typesetting so that every one of those books would have to be redone. We were unable to come out with any fall books. I think one of the worst things they did was that they took the chemicals we had in the shop and poured them over 5,000 copies of a plain brown wrapper by Rita Mae Brown that was in the bindery, so that the book that was selling the best at that point was taken out of commission and put out of print. We have been placed in a really difficult financial, I think that's a euphemism, a very bad financial position by this. In fact, we see no way to really recover from such a setback within the next year at all. Right now, we're just trying to get our presses back into operation and trying to personally recover from such an emotionally devastating blow. I think that for me, the part about this vandalism that was so upsetting was that I came into the shop in the morning and work that I had done with my own hands for the last 5 years was there on the floor, all destroyed, done in probably a matter of an hour or so. The original paste up of Songs to a Handsome Woman, which was the first book that we ever published and the first book that Rita Mae Brown had come out by the Women's Press, was ripped up page by page. And it was as if this thing that we had created and produced and put our whole lives into for the last 6 years was hated and wrecked and ruined. And it was a very hard thing for all of us to take and very difficult for us to try to keep going. But women all over the country have responded in a way that has been absolutely fantastic. Adrienne Rich and Susan Griffin wrote a statement supporting the press and urging people to send contributions to us. Judith McDaniels organized a benefit for us at Skidmore where they sold things. All kinds of women all over the country have done things. And I really would like to urge all of you that if you have any way in which you can support us, that you do so now at this time when we need it most. We need contributions which can be sent to the press in Oakland at 4400 Market Street. We need people to organize benefits and do readings. For example, Outmount Books is going to publish a series of broadsides, including one by Audre Lorde that will be sold for $2 and the money will go to us. Any people who others of you who do things like that, we really appreciate it and need it. And of course, we need to have all of our books taught in women's studies courses. So if you can get our books into women's studies courses, you should do that. We have a booth, an exhibit at the MLA. It's booth number 1007, and it's in on the fourth floor of the Palmer House. And we have pictures there of the press, so you can see all the different kinds of equipment we have and pictures of the 18 women who do the works. And we have also pictures of the vandalism and catalogs. So we look forward to seeing you all there.
Thank you, Kalita. Let me repeat the address. You may not have gotten it. She went through it so quickly. It's Diana Press, 4400 Market Street, Oakland, California. The zip code is 94608.
I don't think it would be inappropriate at this time if people want to make a contribution since the women from the press are here to do that. I don't know if somebody has a hat or whatever, but I think that we should try since we're all here together.
Does anyone have a hat?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. For the panel, the final one. I'm just going to do a very brief background for some of you who may have missed New York. This afternoon's panel grew out of an MLA panel last year on which Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, June Jordan, and Honor Moore spoke to us about the relationship between their identity as women, as blacks, as lesbians, and their poetry. Last year, I learned how little other women understand about any of the language that I claim as essential to my identity. Too often in my past, I felt alienated in an environment such as this, felt that the structure, atmosphere, architecture of academic meetings eroded and devoured the meaning of my words and made my syntax hemorrhage. There's also menstruation, I could have thought of that. I would feel my connections to my language drain away and dissolve. Last year at MLA, I sat in another large room with women, with tears in my eyes, listening to women I didn't know object to Adrienne Rich's saying that there was a lesbian in every woman, and they couldn't accept, quote, the Freudian implications of the word lesbian. It doesn't have any for me. I sat, I raged in silence, not knowing how to explain that, although I had loved women and only women, emotionally, physically, and sexually for 24 years, I had not been able to let the word lesbian pass my lips in all those years. That in 1972, when I first tried to apply that name to myself, I stuttered, I whispered, I choked. I could not say the word lesbian in 1972. Last year, I still didn't know how to explain the importance of that word in my life to other women. This panel grew out of my silence last year, naming ourselves, naming our lives, naming our actions. Without language, I am nameless, I am invisible, I am silent. If I refuse language, I refuse myself. Through my language, I define myself to myself, and I can see myself. My language always goes before me, illuminating my actions. Through my language, I create myself, for myself and for other women. Last year, I suddenly found myself, later on, telling another woman my coming out story. The story of how and when I became a lesbian, although I had other words for myself. Queer, homosexual, gay. But I was telling her then all the senses in which I now use the word lesbian. I was telling her, in short, the story of my life. I halted, stumbled, and paused throughout that narrative. My story was broken by long silences, which, while I groped in my mind for words, phrases, metaphors, through which I might communicate myself to her. I wanted her to understand me as I understand me, and I discovered in that telling that my life, my coming out, was a narrative of silences, the silence of denial, of self-hatred, and of pain. Later, I told another woman of that long and painful narration. She asked me, "Did you tell her everything?" I said, "Yes, everything I thought was important." She said, "Did you tell her everything?" Did you tell her about your long silences, with other women. And I was glad that I could say, yes. I told her about my long silences, my pain, and my muteness. Too many of us still want to believe that language is a trivial, irrelevant issue that is not a women's concern. The patriarchy devalues language for us in two ways. First, we are told that the continued use of man, mankind, he, chairman, etc., pick a word, and all the rest of masculinist English is, quote, correct, and always has been, and that changing the language is both useless and impossible. Second, within the patriarchy, language is used to deceive, to coerce, and to protect those in power, namely white male heterosexuals. Women cannot allow men to continue to control English. We must make that language our own, as it once was. We must end the millennia of silence about our lives, because if we don't, we will be unable to define our lives in ways that are different from what we know now. As a lesbian, I understand the importance of language in my life. With language, I can claim aspects of myself that I have denied. I can express ideas that have been suppressed and tabooed in our society. With language, I can define my life as real, and I can act to change my life. The women I've asked to be here this afternoon understand language and silence, and language and action. They need hardly any introduction. Mary Daly is with us from Boston. She has a book forthcoming, please watch for it. Fall of 78, Beacon Press is publishing it. It is called Gyne-Ecology, The Metaethics of Radical Feminism, Fall 78. And some of what she will be talking to us about comes from that book. Audre Lorde is with us. She is a black, radical, militant, lesbian, feminist. She proudly claims all of those labels. I may have gotten in the wrong order. Judith McDaniel from Skidmore College, a scholar and a poet, and the present coordinator, Gay Caucus for Modern Languages, a woman whom I greatly respect. And Adrienne Rich, who will also have a new book of poetry coming out from Norton. Please watch for it. Without further ado, you've been very patient. I will ask Mary to be our first speaker.
An essential point which I would like to make is that we exist in a state of possession. And secondly, I'd like to talk about the fact that we exist in a state of war. And from that, move to speaking of female friendship. When I even began to try to think about the state of possession, I realized that words fail, that words are trapped. And it isn't only a matter of having to create new words, but of having to look into the deep background of the very old words, which are women's words. For example, hag, harpy, crone, fury, spinster. The Christians, of course, used to speak of hagiography and hagiology as the saints' lives, but these martyrs of masochism would hardly, I think, be adequate examples for surviving spinsters, lesbians. And so I guess I would have to think that what I'm doing is hagology. And what I would hope to work toward becoming is hagocracy. Hag, according to Webster's, has an archaic meaning. Fury, harpy, it means an evil or frightening spirit. It also means nightmare. Who's nightmare? Haggard is also an appropriate adjective. One would hope that we are doing haggard speaking, writing, acting. Haggard means wild, untamed, in a so-called archaic meaning. Haggard writing, speaking, is by and for haggard women, those who are intractable, willful, wanton, unchaste, and especially those who are reluctant to yield to wooing. It belongs to the tradition of those who refuse to assume the woes of wooed women, who cast off these woes as unworthy of hags or harpies. Haggard women are not man-wooed, as furies, women in the tradition of the great hags reject the curse of compromise. The great hags of history, of course, when their lives have not been prematurely terminated, have become crones, by the long-lasting ones. They are the survivors of the perpetual witch craze of patriarchy. I suggest that what we are doing, then, is not mere chronology, but chronology. And therefore what we are looking for is not mere herstory, you know, history's little sister, but prehistory, our own prehistory, prior not only in time, but in importance. A spinster, of course, is a woman who spins. This is its primary definition. To spin has many meanings, you know. All great goddesses spin and weave. To spin is to whirl and twirl. To reverse, to spin on one's heel, to turn everything upside down. So we don't always have to look for brand new words, is part of my message. One night I sort of went into a trance and was thinking about dispossession as we move more into the territory, the terrain of hags, crones, harpies, furies, spinsters, witches, thugs. In the state of possession, what happens? Under the appearance of bonding, there is binding. The mothers bind the feet and minds of daughters. The daughter is turned against the mother. The pseudo-sister is the re-sister of her sister, standing against her. As her re-sister, she is a reverse imitation, a mirror image, her lifelike imitation. She covers and recovers the sister within, until she can no longer find herself, having forgotten to search for herself. Trapped into re-searching, she finds only the re-sister, the re-sister. In order truly to search for the sister within, it is necessary to see the dismembered sister, the sister self, and to remember her, coming into touch with the original intuition of integrity. Once mindful of her, the self need no longer resist her. Her mind is full of her. She is her. She is herself. Remembering is remedy. Reign of healing is within the self. Within the self, seen by the self and seeing the self. The remedy is not to turn back, but to become in a healing environment. The self is this healing environment. And in this space, the self is not religious, not tied back by old ligatures, false allegiances. She pledges allegiance to no flag, no cross. She sees through the lies of her alleged lies, for she is freeing herself from fears. This space, the self's holy environment, is the opposite of the recovery rooms of unnatural positions of soul and body. In our discovery room, our self-discovery room, reversing refrains that have framed our knowing into so-called knowledge, we need here to stay. We need not stay in the hearses. the false positions have made of our bodies, our minds, when they made us rehearse each reversed truth, boxing them into coffins of deception, our false selves. No need to repeat the refrains of the rituals that we strain ourselves, that strain ourselves. I think that we, if we think of the image of the painted bird in Kosinski's novel, you know, Thomas Vaz used that as a paradigm of the scapegoat. But with women, you know, the painted bird is not the one torn apart by her own kind, as Zaz would use the metaphor, but rather it is the woman who seeks her own self, her own inner being, her nature, who is torn apart by the painted ones, by the resistance. For we live in a state of total tokenism, of possession. It could be a situation of having 99% women, you know, in an organization, or as leaders of an organization, and if consciousness is still possessed, it would still be a place of painted birds. The problem is to unpeel the paint. The problem is also to break out of the time warps. And I think in the state of possession, time warps are one of the primary ways in which we experience the total killing of our history. There's a kind of spooking experience that many of us have had, which you might call old is new. This is shared among crones now, who have been consciously feminist since the late 60s, and who are now meeting a generation of younger women, college students, for example, who have never read and never even heard the second sex, sisterhood is powerful, the first sex, we have been struggling to build women's studies courses and programs, and we speak to each other of this eerie experience, sometimes almost in whispers, seeking confirmation of our own memories. It's like beginning from square one. It's like reinventing the wheel, some say. It's like, it's as if nothing had ever happened. They seem lobotomized. We stare around at this belief and we say, we should have foreseen this. And indeed, we should have foreseen this. Had we not too had our history torn from us, our prehistory stolen from us? Probably Matilda Joslyn Gaze, which wrote Woman, Church, and State in the end of the 19th century, thought too that she was building a tradition which would not be torn apart, ripped apart, erased. So everywhere we face erasure, the stealing of our past. We find also that our future is stolen at every moment. And since our past is possessed, we are prevented from presence in our present. We have seen the runners, the rulers, the patriarchal institutions administer preventive medicine to us by destroying and remaking the past, inspiring us with lies, with fears, with the disease of caution and self-contempt. It's a state of possession. Another way to put it is that it is a state of war. And I would suggest that when we consider that this is a state of war, patriarchy is perpetual war. What they call peace is a mere interlude. That the primary enemy of all patriarchal wars, the enemy, with capital B, is the self in every woman. The enemy is the self in every woman. And it's necessary very deeply, I think, to understand the mind trick that happens, because then we have thrown at us such statements as, what, you think men are the enemy? But that isn't the case. That's, one reacts normally to a possessive situation, repressive, obsessive, destructive situation, is that women have been set up, targeted, as the enemy. I would suggest that it is very important for us, in our thinking of bonding together, to look at the very words we have to use then in the state of enmity. We have such words as friend, sister, lover. Friend, it may be said, is an old word. Then let us claim it as a very old word, as a haggard word. It is chronologically important to recall that the word friend is derived from the Old English term meaning to love, and that it is akin in its roots to an Old English word meaning free. The radical friendship of hags then means loving our own freedom, loving the freedom of the other, the friend, and therefore loving freely. in every one of us, you know, over and over again, there are the residues of the injections of perceiving ourselves as the enemy. Because insofar as we belong to that, or believe we have belonged to that, been included in that possessed state, then we have to see the female self as the enemy, the not friend, the enemy. The point is now to see the self as the friend. And the result of that, I would suggest, would be extremely mind-boggling. In The Warriors, J. Glenn Gray, it's an alleged classic about war, described the male position about comradeship and friendship. He said, the essential difference between comradeship and friendship consists in a heightened awareness of the self in friendship and in the suppression of self-awareness in comradeship. Now, since brotherhood and fraternity are roughly equivalent to male comradeship, males perceive a sharp contrast between the bonding designated by these terms of bonding and friendship. What happens then if they unselfconsciously think of sisterhood as a sort of gender equivalent to brotherhood? I suggest that we fall into this trap of thinking of it as something totally other from friendship. Women breaking away from the feminine condition often tend to first imitate male comradeship, initially misperceiving sisterhood as something like the female equivalent of brotherhood. However, crones who have persisted in our other world journey have come to know deeply that sisterhood, like female friendship, has at its core the affirmation of freedom. Thus, sisterhood differs radically from male comradeship, brotherhood, which functions to perpetuate the state of war. And since sisterhood is deeply like female friendship, rather than being its opposite, as in the case of the male semantic counterparts, it is radically self-affirming. It is totally different from brotherhood, and we must also, I think, often and continually remind ourselves that it is other, that the surface likeness must be constantly exercised when you speak. Many male authors admit that comradeship, brotherhood, is based upon a kind of numbing of consciousness. Female friendship, lesbian love, you know, sisterhood, all bearing these patterns, the same female-identified relating, are not like this. Sisterhood is the expression of biophilic energy burning through the encasements of the necrophilic state of staledom, maledom. It is more complex than mere male monogender merging. And since bonding theories are not primarily concerned with merely fighting, but with breaking boundaries, bounding free, our ecstasy is totally other than their war ecstasy. However, crones also know that since the female self, who is friend to herself, is the enemy targeted by patriarchy, the bonding of ourselves is perceived by the warriors as the ultimate threat to be shot down with every big gun available. And given such conditions, the siege furies do fight back. Thus, there is a warrior element in sisterhood. There is then an element in haggard bonding, which is us versus a third, and which is positively furious. Yet, crones know that this warrior aspect of Amazon bonding becomes truly dreadless, daring, only when we have focused it beyond fighting. Our inherited vocabulary is inadequate to express this complexity and its inherent priorities, since it has been dwarfed to accommodate the pale male experience of bonding. In order to overcome this inherited vocabulary of ideology, hags, harpies, must use our double axes, our labyrinths, our minds, our self-identified female minds, to hack away all of its false dichotomies, particularly demonic opposition between sister, friend, lover. For it is the friend in the sister, lover, who defines, limits, expands her role as warrior. It is the free friend who has no need to be consumed in a fire of communal ecstasy like the warriors, to melt in a mass merger. It is the friend in the self who can define sisterhood as other than brotherhood, who can aim the fire of our fury so that it transcends the state of enmity. It is she who can blaze the trails that will lead us journeyers away from the battleground into the deep, deep background of ourselves. I would like to briefly wind up by speaking of invitations to assimilation. just coming to this place, it was a terrible shock. I crawled into the bed for half an hour, went into sort of coma after being on the elevators. In case there is any doubt that sisterhood is unlike male merging, we need to get on the elevators, or perhaps read D.H. Lawrence, who, in his essay on Whitman, had this to say: woman is inadequate to the last merging, so the next step is the merging of man for man love, and this is on the brink of death. Grateful for our inadequacy. Amazons may strive to step aside while a death-loving merger is marching. But the problem is that the merging marchers want to pull women and all of life with them on their death march, sensing that the female self is not willing to join this procession since she is non-necrophilic. They make every effort to deceive her, drug her into an approximation of their own dulled-out state. Described by Robert J. Lifton when he talked about the desensitization of GIs, one merges with them, the men in one's unit, on the basis of shared psychic numbing. That's what I told them all there. President John G. Bauer of Princeton University made the following amazing statement. See, although they only can merge, we are not adequate for the ultimate merging. Nevertheless, merging by numbing, which is male-initiated, we are invited. Ladies are invited. And we should note the disguised guy style of the invitation. The basic form of absorbing women into their army is, of course, tokenism, which is presented as the epitome and goal of feminism. President John G. Bauer of Princeton University made the following statement, which I found by accident in my junk mail, in something a Boston College had handouts on affirmative action, which no longer has anything to do with women. And he stated, "The ultimate objective of affirmative action is to achieve a situation in which every individual from every background feels unselfconsciously included." Unselfconsciously included. Indeed. And President Bauer deems it a goal worthy of our best efforts. Indeed, the goal of patriarchal institutions is unselfconscious inclusion. This is the lethal reversal of the outsider society described by Virginia Woolf. It is a deceptive reversal of sisterhood, which means self-conscious, self-conspirating, exclusion, self-exclusion from the state of possession, the state of war. And of course, they keep this always elusive so that we will expend endless energy trying to attain it. One of the traps also, along with tokenism, is the invitation to self-sacrifice. Along with, because there isn't enough room for all women to be token professors or whatever. And not only is the dreaming everyday housewife invited to self-sacrifice, but also the prominent feminist. And I think this is a trap we have to watch out for, that so deeply mythic is the idea of self-sacrifice in our culture that we have to learn exactly how to refuse this, because it is the temptation to keep us from posing that ultimate threat, which is the bonding of females. By the way, that bonding of self-accepting females, non-self-sacrificial females, does not have to be numerically large. I think one of the tricks is to imagine that it's a matter of numbers. There have to be thousands of them, but it requires two or three of us together to change a whole situation, and that is why I think women find find ourselves so isolated. That is why one speaks to woman after woman after woman, lesbian feminist, who says that she is the only one where she is in her department, her university. Of course, two or three. Right, refusing self-sacrifice. You know, there was a theologian called Paul Tillich, exposed by his wife after his death. He said that what the Christian or perfect person, fulfilled person needs is the courage to accept acceptance. This is so perverted that I can't stop myself. Right? Because you cannot understand that this is what you are invited to do. He says, this is the ultimate theological One could say that the courage to be is the courage to accept oneself as accepted in spite of being unacceptable. The victim of this masochistic Pauline Lutheran doctrine is condemned to live in a prison of mirror images, knowing that she is guilty and deserving of condemnation, but believing a loving God forgives her. Tillich goes on, it is not the good or the wise or the pious who are entitled to the courage to accept acceptance, but those who are lacking in all of these qualities and are aware of being unacceptable. This, however, does not mean acceptance by oneself as oneself. Indeed not. This is the mythic background, theological background, lurking behind such statements as that of President Bauer, who wants unself-conscious assimilation. The ultimate thread of female bonding, of female-identified woman loving, hacks, curious, will be there if we know that whenever there are two or three self-affirming women gathered together in our own names, we are lighting our own fire, sparking. And then we can stop worrying about false problems of numbers. For I think that ironically, you know, patriarchal males show evidence of grasping this better than women. Patriarchal males realize that they have made a colossal commitment to covering up their own individual weakness. It's this bonding that you see in the elevators and in these rooms where they're reading their ditties. Indeed, male bonding comradeship requires the stunting of individuality. In contrast to this, female-identified bonding is based upon highly individualized strength of self-accepting hags. It takes time, of course, to reach the point of being self-accepting, because all of the vocabulary wants to keep us from this. This means a kind of separation, separatism. I would suggest that, although O etymologists, I'm sure Julian would back this up, would say that separate is supposedly from se, meaning apart, and parare, meaning to get ready, set. I wouldn't bother disputing this correct etymology, but would suggest it's possible to look at the word in another way and say it's from se, meaning self, and to see also that the Latin parare is the root of the verb to pair. When spinsters, lesbians, speak of separatism, the deep questions that are being asked concern the problem of pairing away from this self, the layers and layers of false selves. And it is the separatism within, I suggest, that must be normative for all of our external separations, our judgments about separations from groups. For example, whether when you make decisions about whether you have alliances with gay men. Since each self is unique, since each woman has her own history, and since there are deep differences in temperament and abilities, we must make room for this variety. And it is true that all women have had similar experiences. It is also true, however, that there have been wide variations on the theme of possession, of the theme of war. To simplify the differences would be to settle for a less than dreadful judgment of the multiple horrors of gynocidal universities, hospitals, churches, professions, would be to impoverish our imaginations and to minimize variety in Amazon juniors' experiences, temperaments and talents would only reduce us again to an imitation, brotherhood, comradeship. There are still large gaps in our speech, large silences, places where we don't know where to turn for words. Whereas discussions of relations between men and women eulogize the so-called complementarity of opposites, our analysis of female friendship love discovers the fact that the basis of woman-identified relations is either biological or socially constructed roles. And as each friend moves more deeply into her background, she discovers the terrifying differences between us. And this is part of the frightening aspect of our journey. Yet this is also what requires our sincerity with each other, because we have no role definitions to lean upon. Our equality has to be, as Jen Raymond expressed it, equality to the task, equality to the third thing, the adventurous voyage. And that means facing the horror of horrors, which is, I think, not so much the males who are the enemies, but the painted birds created all around us who also fill the elevators, and facing the fact that those painted birds are also within ourselves.
I'd like to preface my remarks on the transformation of silence into language and action with a poem. The title of it is A Song for Many Movements, and this reading is dedicated to Winnie Mandela. Winnie Mandela is a South African freedom fighter who is in exile now, somewhere in northern South Africa. She had been in prison and had been released and was picked up again after she spoke out against the jailing of black school children who were singing freedom songs and who were jailed under the charge of public violence. Was A Song for Many Movements. Nobody wants to die on the way, caught between ghosts of whiteness and the real water. None of us wanted to leave our bones on the way to salvation. Three planets to the left, a century of light years ago. Our spices are separate and particular, but our skins sing in complementary keys. At a quarter to eight, meantime, we were telling the same stories over and over and over. But broken down gods survive in the crevasses and mud pots of every beleaguered city, where it is obvious there are too many bodies to cart to the ovens or gallows, and our uses have become more important than our silence. After the fall, too many empty cases of blood to bury or burn, and there will be no body left to listen then. Our labor has become more important than our silence. Our labor has become more important than our silence. In listening to Mary, I was struck by how many of the words seem to come up. I know they did in her paper, and I know that they do in mine, words such as war, such as separation, such as fear, and the ways in which those are intimately connected with our battles against silence and the distortions that silence commit upon us. I have come to believe over and over that what is most important to me must be spoken, made verbal and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood. That the speaking profits me beyond any other effect. I am standing here as a black lesbian poet, and the meaning of all that waits upon the fact that I am alive at all, and I had not thought to be. Less than 2 months ago, I was told by two doctors, one female and one male, that I would have to have breast surgery, and that there was a 60 to 80% chance that the tumor was malignant. Between that telling and the actual surgery, there was a 3-week period of the agony of an involuntary reorganization of my entire life. The surgery was completed and the growth was benign. But within those 3 weeks, I was forced to look upon myself and my living with a harsh and urgent clarity that has left me, even now, still shaken, but much stronger. This is a situation I know faced by many women, by some of you perhaps here now. But some of what I experienced during that time has helped to elucidate for me much of what I feel concerning the transformation of silence into language and action. In becoming forcibly and essentially aware of what mortality meant for me, of what I wished and wanted for my life, however short it might be, priorities and omissions became very strongly etched in a merciless light, and what I most regretted were my silences. Of what had I ever been afraid? To question or to speak what I believed could have meant pain or death, but we all hurt all the time in so many different ways, and pain either changes